This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you all for coming. My name is Malik Shah. I'm a neurologist here at UCSF, and I was invited by the coordinators of the course to come and talk a little bit about neurology mysteries. And I will say up front that I'm very junior in my career, so a lot of the cases will be kind of learning from my mistakes and things that I've learned from other people, but hopefully you guys will find that equally interesting. So what I thought we'd talk about today is, first of all, just kind of going through what are the tools that we have as neurologists to figure out what's happening to our patients. And we have a number of tools, the majority of which is, you know, sort of the history and the neurologic examination. In addition to the tools, we also have to take into account anatomy. You know, what structures in the brain are next to each other? How does the brain communicate with the spinal cord and the nerves and the muscles? And there's certain types of symptoms and certain patterns of weakness that help us understand which part of the nervous system is involved. In addition to that, so that would be the sort of the first third or so of the talk, and then the second two-thirds, I want to show a couple cases that highlight some of these tools that we used and hopefully will be interesting and sort of give you a sense of the different types of things we see on the neurology service. I've been asked to save questions till the end of the talk, if that's okay with everybody. So We have a bunch of different tools, but I think still the most important tool that we have as neurologists is the clinical interview. And what I mean by that is, you know, talking to the patient or often the patient's family, relatives, neighbors, whoever can give us history about what's happened. And the things we want to know are, you know, what are the symptoms? What are the patient experiencing? A lot of times people have a lot of symptoms, so we always want to start with what was the first thing that happened. And then another important thing is, well, how quickly did this happen? Is this something that you woke up and you immediately had a symptom, or is it something that's been going on for many years? Obviously, you think about different things with different sort of tempo of onset. In addition to the symptoms, we also want to know, well, who are you in terms of your past medical history? What other medical problems do you have? What medications are you taking? Any habits, alcohol, cigarette smoking that might put you at higher risk for certain types of illnesses, anything that runs in the family, obviously very important to know. In terms of the clinical interview, there are some challenges. It's not always so easy just to sit and get a history. A lot of our patients don't speak English, for example, and so we have to use sort of a translator or broken Spanish or other languages that we know. A lot of times the patient is coming in with symptoms like confusion. They're disoriented, so they can't always tell us exactly what they're experiencing because that's sort of the problem. That's what brought them here. So we have to use also the medical chart and history from family members. In addition, a lot of the symptoms that we deal with are just hard for people to describe. I've had a lot of patients that say, you know, I can't tell you exactly what I'm feeling. Something is just wrong, or it feels funny, or they use kind of vague terms. And it's not any fault of their own. It's just that we don't have sort of enough vocabulary in our language to probably encapsulate a lot of these symptoms. Another thing that we deal with is sometimes the way we think about certain symptoms and certain buzz terms is very different than what the patient feels. So one good example is the concept of dizziness or vertigo or feeling lightheaded. And as neurologists, we think about those in very different boxes, and it helps, and we think about different parts of the neurologic system. But for patients, they often run together, and dizziness and vertigo are interchangeable. And there are certain cultures as well where dizziness is kind of a general term for I don't feel well. So people just say, I feel dizzy. And it's not that they feel like the room is spinning or they're going to fall down, but that's just the way of them communicating, I don't feel good, I feel sick. So we have to sort of navigate that. The other thing that we often deal with, especially as neurologists, is weakness. People often say, I feel weak everywhere. Every part of my body is weak. And we have to sort of tangle, well, by weakness, do you mean fatigue? Do you mean pain? Do you mean low energy? Or do you mean actually that the muscles are not activating or that you're trying to move, but you can't? So that's something we have to tease apart with our history as well as the examination. Another thing we deal with a lot of times is people have certain expectations about what a symptom is. For example, something we often talk about is migraine headaches. And I think everybody thinks about a migraine headache and they have a certain sort of schematic of what that is. And everybody has a little different experience of that. And when you talk about headaches, people will be very adamant about, well, what I have is not a migraine. And so we have to always take a step back and say, well, migraines actually have different flavors. And if you ask different people, it's experienced in different ways. So these are some of the challenges with the interview. The other skill that you learn as a neurologist is sometimes you need to ask about a symptom that's very specific, and it's not always something you can that the patient will just volunteer. So a symptom that we always worry about is numbness over the buttocks, for example. And so a delicate way to ask that is, well, do you notice that when you clean yourself, it feels funny, or you don't feel when you clean yourself? And sometimes patients will say, you know, I never thought about that, but yeah, now that you mention it, I don't feel the toilet paper when I clean myself. Similarly, feeling differences in temperature is sort of hard to ask. So you give it sort of a real-world example. When you turn on the water, hot or cold in the shower, do you sort of jump out immediately, or do you not even notice how hot the temperature is? Or do other people in your family say, I can't believe you're taking a shower in this temperature. This is scalding hot. Other types of things that are helpful are, you know, in terms of weakness, well, how is it exactly affecting you? What things can and can't you do? Can you reach up and grab something from a top shelf? Can you get out of a chair by yourself? Can you walk? So sometimes it's more asking about specific functions that help us understand which part of the body is weak. Along with the history, the sort of the next part of our toolkit is the actual examination. And it's really an examination that's sort of developed over centuries in terms of how neurologists approach a patient and work through their symptoms. The benefit of the neurologic examination is that we're doing specific things to really test function of the entire neuroaxis. So that includes the brain, spinal cord, nerves, and muscles. And each part of the examination is sort of a direct test of those different structures. And then when you put the examination together, you can sort of figure out, well, here's where the problem seems to be. And that leads you into your diagnostic testing and diagnosis. So I thought we'd talk a little bit about the examination. I don't know how many people have seen a neurologist, but you probably have been through some of these things if you have, or for that matter, any sort of doctor who's doing a sort of brief neurologic examination. The first thing we assess is the way you're thinking. And that's simple things like, are you awake? Are you comatose? But also more complex things like, can you understand sort of complex language? Can you follow complex commands? If I give you a list of things to remember, how easy or hard is that for you? And a lot of this is tailored to the type of symptoms people are having. If someone comes in and says, well, I feel numb in my hand, I probably won't spend all day focusing about the mental status examination. But if someone says, you know, over the last couple of years, I'm having a lot of difficulty with memory, then I'll spend more time with this. And what I'm showing here on the side is kind of a side view of the brain and sort of an introduction to neuroanatomy. So just to orient you, this is sort of, if you're looking at the head on side, this would be the front of the brain, and this would be the back. And there's sort of four main lobes to the brain, the frontal lobe, the parietal lobe, the temporal lobe, which is kind of near the ear, and the occipital lobe, which controls vision. And these just highlight some important structures when you're thinking about the mental statics examination, specifically Broca's and Wernicke's area. These are intimately involved in language function, and they actually have different roles. One of them is sort of how you talk and express yourself, and one is sort of how you understand language. And I also wanted to show this figure just to show you how close the language centers are to other parts of the brain, including this area here and this area here, which control movement and sensation. And the way the brain works is the left side of your brain controls the right side of your body. And we'll come back to this a couple more times. The next step of the examination is the cranial nerve examination. And what we have here is now we're looking at the brain sort of, if I were to turn you over and look at it from looking up at the nose, the bottom of the brain has a structure called the brain stem, which is sort of the bundle of all the fibers and nerves coming from the larger part of the brain that helps control all the functions involved with breathing, as well as has the nuclei for the optic nerves, cranial nerves. And there's sort of 12 nerves, and they control functions involving taste, vision, hearing, sense of balance and eye movements. And so if you see those type of problems on your examination or patients are complaining of those type of symptoms, knowing where the cranial nerves go through the brain and which part of the brain they're connected to helps you quickly identify what part of the brain is affected by this symptom. So this is sort of the second part of the examination. There's certain maneuvers you do to sort of test the function of these nerves. The next part is assessing motor function. And that involves not only sort of testing isolated muscles, depending on what people are experiencing or what people are saying is weak, but also getting a sense of what's the sort of pattern of weakness. Is it muscles just in one hand? That would be very different than muscles involving the shoulders, for example, or involving the thighs. Is it the muscles involved with neck flexion and extension? And part of this is also involving the muscles that control respiration. In terms of the control of motor activity, the sort of starting place is in the cerebral cortex, but then there's nerves that travel down through the brainstem and then further down into the spinal cord and come out of the spinal cord and go to the individual muscles. And so you can see that there's a sort of a long route where motor activity is performed and completed, and there can be problems at any area of that whole circuit. And when someone comes in saying that they're feeling weak, one of our jobs is to figure out with the examination, well, which part of that circuit is actually weak, and that helps us understand what the problem might be. So this is just a diagram sort of highlighting that. So what we have here is the brain, if you were sort of to cut it down the center like this and look at it from left and right. So these are the two halves of the brains. And there's a structure here called the motor cortex or the motor strip, which actually has a very specific organization where the legs, so the strength of the legs is sort of in the middle part of the brain, and then the hand, and then the face. And you can see sort of this very nice organization that was created, you know, through evolution, basically. And all these fibers then run from those different parts of this organization, which we call the homunculus, which means little man. And then they sort of come together into more to sort of specific nerve fibers that run through the middle of the brain, down the brainstem that we talked about earlier, and then come into this structure, which is the spinal cord. And then in the spinal cord, they leave depending on their target. So you can imagine the spinal cord is the nerve, the bundle of nerves that travels from your neck all the way down to your lower back. The sort of nerves that control movement of the hands will come out sooner, and then the abdominal muscles, and then the legs at the very end. So it starts with organization up here, it comes together, but then it also becomes sort of even more organized when they leave the spinal cord and go to their targets. And when they leave the spinal cord, this is a figure showing the spinal cord, so you can sort of see the little butterfly shape there and there. These are the nerves as they exit the spinal cord. They become thinner nerves, and then they come and sort of communicate directly with the muscle. And the connection between the nerve and the muscle is the neuromuscular junction. So again, just to reiterate what I was saying before, you can have problems causing weakness in the muscle, in the nerves, in that junction, in the spinal cord, and as far up as the brain. So when people come in and saying they're weak, we use the examination to try to figure out, well, which part of this system is not working. The sensory exam has similar organization. The interesting thing about the sensory exam is that the pathways for different types of sensation, such as pain and temperature versus kind of fine sensation and vibration, actually have different pathways within the spinal cord and the brain. So knowing those relationships helps us understand which part of the brain is affected. And then you'll probably all know that we often like to check reflexes. That's when we bring out the hammer and kind of poke at joints. And the idea of that, beside the entertainment that we get out of it, is to actually understand what type of injury within the motor system is occurring. So when there's injury within the brain or spinal cord, the reflexes are sort of jumpy, or we call brisk. But when the injury is within the nerve or out of the spinal cord in the muscle, the reflexes become diminished. So actually, we're sort of looking for a reactivity to help us put together, along with the weakness, where this problem is. Another thing that we test for is the function of this structure at the base of the brain called the cerebellum, which to be honest, we don't completely understand, but and it probably has a lot of functions, but we know that it's very involved with things like coordination and balance and has a lot of connections to the higher parts of the brain. And so when people come in complaining of problems with balance or discoordination, these are the this is the sort of testing that we do to understand if the cerebellum is involved. And that involves not only doing things with their hands and legs, but also how do people walk. You can imagine if you have prominent problem with balance, that's going to be sort of the main problem. And then going to that, one of the most important things we do is just watching someone walk. And we can tell a lot by the way someone walks as to, you know, what is causing their walking problem or if there's a walking problem at all. So we sort of talked a little bit about this, but using the examination helps you create certain patterns of abnormalities. So for example, when you're seeing someone who has weakness, like we talked about, if the problem's in the brain or spinal cord, you might see things like rigidity or what we call increased tone, where the arms or the limbs are very stiff. They'll have brisk reflexes and they'll have weakness in a certain pattern. Whereas if it's the sort of nerves as they come out of the spinal cord or the muscles, the tone becomes decreased and the limbs can be sort of floppy. The reflexes can be lost, and that's when people often start to lose muscle mass as well. One thing that I'm sure people know about is ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, and it actually has a combination of these two types of patterns because the pathology there is within the both upper and lower motor neuron nerve. Similarly, if you think someone has a problem with spinal cords, something that can be very helpful is knowing that each level of the spinal cord controls sensation of one part, sort of one patch of the body. So if I'm seeing someone who has numbness up to their abdomen, but the rest of their body is fine, then I can quickly tell that there's a problem in the spinal cord. People with spinal cord problems also have difficulty with bowel and bladder function, so that's a helpful clue. Something else that we often see in clinic is what we call Parkinsonism, which doesn't imply necessarily that someone has Parkinson's disease, but has a constellation of findings that include a tremor of the hands, very slowed movements, and difficulty initiating movement, and a very specific type of walking associated with the rigidity and sort of slow shuffling steps. So in terms of how the examination is limited, well, there is a certain skill to it, so there can be differences across people. Things change rapidly, so the examination is not always a constant thing, and you have to be aware that depending on what disease you're dealing with, things can change. Another thing we often deal with is we see an abnormality and we have to put it in the context of what the patient's symptoms are. Is this something that has always been there? Has their reflexes always been brisk and is unrelated to their problem, or is it actually related to their problem? And then the other thing that often comes up is sometimes it's not as simple as the problem's in one place, but it's in many places. And so we have to interpret the exam and always think about, could this be something that's affecting many parts of the nervous system? So in addition to the history and examination, we also have some diagnostic testing. And I always joke with my residents that there's really only four tests that we sort of do. So you can never be wrong if you throw out a test or two, because your chances are pretty good. So probably the most important thing we do in terms of diagnostic testing is getting pictures. And there are different types of pictures. You may have heard about CAT scans or CT scans or MRI scans. You can also get imaging of the vessels as they go into the brain, the arteries and veins. Something called an EMG NCS or a nerve conduction study basically is an electrodiagnostic test of nerves and muscle function using a needle and electrodes to really test exactly how the nerves are affected if you're worried about a problem in the peripheral nervous system outside of the spinal cord. Another test we often do is a lumbar puncture, also called a spinal tap, where we're basically sampling the fluid that bathes the brain and spinal cord to look for signs of inflammation, which can be a sign of infection or autoimmune disease. And then the other big test we often do is an EEG, which is where you put stickers on someone's head to measure the electrical activity, and that's a helpful test when you're studying seizures. I did want to show in an MRI scan so that people have, a sense of orientation. So this is an MRI, a normal MRI scan, and what we're seeing is the brain sort of cut through the axial slice, sort of cut this way. And so, for example, here you can see the eyes and the nose. That's the front of the brain, and that's the back. and we're just going to go from the bottom up. So just to show those structures that we've been talking about, the bottom of the brain, remember, you have the cerebellum here, and then this sort of bundle here and here is the brainstem. And then as you come further up on the sides by the ears, you have the temporal lobes. And then as you come further up, you come up to the rest of the brain, as well as the motor cortex and the sensory cortex that's separated by this larger sort of what we call sulci, just sort of a division within the brain. So this is something that we learned very early on in training, how to interpret these scans, but also knowing the neuroanatomy. So when you see problems, you know exactly where it is. This is just an example of an EEG just to show people what it looks like. It's basically a bunch of squiggly lines, and I'm convinced they just make up what they see because it's pretty hard to interpret. But basically, it's stickers all over different parts of the brain, and you're getting a sense of brain activity, both in terms of real-time sort of spatial temporal resolution, but also different parts of the brain, and you can look for asymmetries left and right. The other big tool that has always been there, but I think is particularly great for the modern neurologist, is the sort of advent of literature and emails that's available through the internet. And I think the world has become a lot smaller, and we have the great advantage of being able to not only look up the work of our colleagues around the world, but also sometimes directly email them if we have relationships and say, what do you think about this? I'm seeing a patient with this type of problem. What do you think about this MRI scan? And that's particularly helpful when you're dealing with sort of rare conditions or you sort of want to, consult with an expert. You still have to know sort of where to look and what you're looking for, because there is almost too much information. But that's definitely an important tool that we have. Before we get into cases, just one last thing. One of my colleagues actually sort of studied this. He went to neurology clinics and watched them do their practice and design this cube, which sort of just shows how people spend their time in clinic, how neurologists work. And as you can see, they sort of focus their time in three domains, the things we talked about. One is sort of the clinical, the exam, and the history. These are sort of lab work, blood test, and EEG and EMG, and then also looking at imaging. And he sort of just described how different types of problems, you spend different amount of time in these different domains. So it's kind of an interesting way to sort of see how neurologists think and organize their thinking depending on what type of problem they're dealing with. So those are sort of the tools we deal with, and I thought we could spend the rest of the talk sort of going over some interesting cases that highlight the usefulness of these tools, also highlight for me some lessons that I learned along the way. So the first case, sort of keeping with the detective theme, is called the eagle-eyed bystander. So we had a 75-year-old man with high blood pressure and diabetes who suddenly fell to the ground on the crosswalk around 11 a.m. In talking to his wife, she said that he goes for a walk every day in the morning. He takes the same route. And she had left earlier in the morning for an appointment. And when she had left, he had been totally fine, no complaints, and he had been feeling well. When he showed up in the emergency room about half an hour, 45 minutes later, he was awake, but he was unable to talk and couldn't follow commands. His right face was sort of drooped and weak, and he also was paralyzed on the right side of his body. He could move his left side, but he really seemed to only be paying attention to one side of his body. And again, he was unable to talk or communicate with us. So just to sort of talk about the anatomic localization, like we were sort of saying before, if you have weakness on one side of the body, you always think about the opposite side of the brain causing the problem. So right-sided symptoms, left brain. We know that there might be some sort of visual problem. He's only paying attention to one half of the room. And again, a visual problem on the right side makes you think about the opposite hemisphere. And then the other big clue for him in this case was that he was unable to talk or follow commands. He was what we call globally aphasic, which is just a term that means sort of all function of language was absent. And language is interesting because it actually, most of the time, is a left hemisphere function. Basically, 90% of all people who are right-handed will have language in the left side of their brain, sort of one of the quirks of development. So seeing that symptom, plus the other things, we knew right away that this is a problem in the left hemisphere. And if you remember the figure I showed you, the motor, the language, the sensory, they're all kind of near each other. And whenever someone has an acute problem like this, the first thing we think about is this person most likely has had a stroke. And what a stroke is basically a blockage of blood vessels within the brain. It's sort of the equivalent of a heart attack or myocardial infarction of the heart, but now it's involving the brain. And so knowing the relationship of the blood vessels going into the brain and knowing the relationship of that to the actual anatomy of the brain, we can figure out quickly just by the examination that this patient had an injury to the middle cerebral artery. And I'll show you on the next slide why we can be certain about that. And whenever we see this, you know, aside from our examination, we need a scan right away to see if this stroke is due to bleeding within the brain or due to blockage in the artery, what we call an ischemic stroke, where there's not enough blood getting into the brain. And so remember our figure here that we talked about, we have the different structures that we highlighted, and in this case, all of these are sort of affected. And this figure just shows in sort of a color pattern how the different vessels within the brain, what part of the brain they supply. So knowing that the middle cerebral artery covers this entire territory, we can tell by the examination that that's sort of where the blockage is most likely to be. So this is actually the imaging from this patient. He had a CT scan, which we can get very quickly. It doesn't have as good detail as the MRI that we just looked at earlier. But what you can see here, and I've sort of highlighted with the circle, is when we gave contrast dye to sort of trace out the vessels, there was an acute blockage here in the right MCA territory. And this is confusing because, well, sorry, I flipped the images. So right, I'm getting confused. Sorry, this the left MCA syndrome, sorry. We talked about left hemisphere. So this is the left part of the brain, and that's the right. So it's kind of the opposite of what you would expect. This shows in a color representation how blood flow is getting through the brain. And all I want you to appreciate here is just that there's an asymmetry of the sort of colors here compared to here. And that tells us that this part of the brain is just not getting enough blood. So we had a clinical diagnosis pretty quickly of a left middle cerebral artery large vessel stroke. And this is ischemic, meaning there's not blood, but there's not blood getting into that area. This patient obviously has severe deficits, so we want to do whatever we can to reverse this. And with stroke, there's really only one good medication that we have for when someone has an acute stroke problem, and that's using a medication called TPA, which is a clot-busting medication that we give through the arteries and sort of goes throughout the body and breaks up clots. The same drug we, again, use sometimes for heart attacks. Based on studies, we know that that drug is only helpful sort of within the first several hours after a stroke. And the guidelines that we have today suggest that the drug should be given within the first 4.5 hours. So this left us with a challenge. How do we figure out when this patient's stroke happened? His wife told us that she saw him normal about 5 hours before he came into the emergency room. But we know he was out for a walk and fell, so it doesn't make sense that the stroke happened right when she left the house. But it happened sometime in between. But we need to sort of convince ourselves that it did before we feel safe giving this medication. Giving the medication after the time limit actually puts the patient at risk for having complications. So we talked to the wife, and she said, well, he goes for the same walk every day. It's an hour loop. And where did he fall? And we told her where he had fallen. She said, oh, well, that's near the end of the route. So we said, oh, that's very helpful because we know we're sort of going through that hour procedure. Then we talked to the police officers who actually went to the scene and picked him up. And they said, well, when we came to the scene, he was already paralyzed and on the floor. So they said, you know, we didn't really see it happen, but by the time we got there, he was already affected. However, there was a woman who actually called us and said, you know, I'm seeing this man on the floor. He's in trouble. We need to get help. And the police officers had actually gotten her phone number. So the next thing we did was call her and say, what did you see? And she could see very clearly that she was on her walk. She saw this gentleman walking across the street, get to the middle part of the crosswalk, and then suddenly collapse. And she could tell us exactly when that was, you know, within 5 or 10 minutes, which was great because there's no way that he could have been walking paralyzed on one side anytime before that. So having her tell us that told us exactly when this stroke had happened. So based on that information, we felt confident and safe giving the clot-busting medication. At this time, he didn't improve initially, so we actually did sort of the second-line treatment, which is sort of a new treatment that is starting to be offered for stroke, where we actually do an angiogram and put a catheter up into the blood vessel and pull out the blood clot. So this is just a photo of this patient's angiogram. So I apologize because we're always shifting sort of the orientation, but this is a vessel called a carotid vessel that comes up from the heart into the neck, and we're this side of the brain, and we're just not seeing because the dye is on this side of the brain. It comes up. This is sort of where the skull is. And then these are two branches, two branch points. And what you can see here is there's like a loss of flow here. And that's where the acute blockage is. And this is the angiogram after the treatment where they are able to take out the clot. So you can sort of see the continuation of that vessel and a lot more vessels here distally. And this is just a photo. Actually, they were able to pull out that clot right there. So this was actually the patient's follow-up scan a day later. And again, this was sort of the tissue that we thought was at risk based on our initial scan, and this is what he ends up having as a final stroke. So he had a very good outcome with this treatment, which was great. And he was able to go home and was actually moving quite well with maybe a little bit of difficulty following commands, but actually was doing great. So whenever I talk to people, I think it's always important to highlight stroke because that's probably the most important disease that we take care of in terms of overall sort of problems in the world. It's the second leading cause of death in the world. It's one of the leading causes of disability, even in patients who survive. The risk factors are the same risk factors as heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, as well as cardiac arrhythmias. And the important thing I hope this case highlighted is that when you have symptoms concerning for a stroke, the treatments that we have are only effective in the acute period in terms of reversing the injury to the brain. And this is a mnemonic that we try to teach all of our patients and teach everybody in the community in terms of symptoms that are concerning for a stroke. We go by the sort of acronym FAST, facial droop or face is uneven like our patient had. The arm is weak. Speech is strange. If you have any of those symptoms, time to call 911. Don't have your spouse or your loved one drive you to the emergency room. Call 911. Get here as soon as possible. So just a couple lessons from this case. Again, this case, we were able to make a diagnosis very quickly, but we really had to use our skills to get the history in order to make it a judgment about treatment. And I just, again, want to emphasize sort of the importance of stroke and recognizing stroke symptoms. Good. So that was the first case. The second case is the case of the sinister reclining armchair. So this was a middle-aged man who came to the emergency room after waking up from sleep and noticing that he couldn't lift up his left hand or fingers and was said to have sort of a wrist drop, and I'll show you a picture of what that looks like. He told us he had had several beers the night before and kind of passed out in the chair with his arm draped over the side of the chair, and he had... Aside from the weakness, he also had tingling over the back. I apologize. It should be his hand. And so the question we had from the emergency room when he came in was, did this patient have a stroke? Is that what happened? He woke up with this weakness. So this is my hand, but that's sort of what a wrist drop looks like. And so really there's two things that we think about when we see this problem, and both can happen rather acutely. One is compression of the radial nerve, and the radial nerve is one of the peripheral nerves that is, you know, comes out from the spinal cord and travels down the arm. And if your arm is kind of hanging over an armchair or over some sort of stable thing, it can just be sort of pinched and compressed, and then it's sort of like having a zinger and it stays weak sometimes for even days. Or you could have a stroke involving the very specific part of the little man homunculus that I showed earlier, what people call the hand knob, and that just means that little sort of bump that controls the hand. Both of them can happen, you know, when you wake up from sleep, they can happen pretty acutely, and sometimes it's hard to know the difference. So the question for us was, well, can you tell the difference and figure out what's going on? So it's helpful, again, to go back to the anatomy of the nerves, and this is a figure showing the path of nerves as they come out of the spinal cord around the shoulder and then travel down the arm, and these are sort of the muscles associated with that. And you can see here sort of in the mid part of the arm is the radial nerve. In addition, we know from anatomy that the radial nerve controls sensation over a very specific part of the hand, which I've sort of highlighted here. when you have a radial neuropathy, we know that it controls certain muscles. So this is actually when you go and test very specific muscles to see if they've been affected or not. And specifically, it affects sort of extension or elevation of the wrist and the fingers, as well as movement of the thumb. You can also have weakness of the triceps muscles, which is a muscle higher up in the arm, if the compression is further up near the armpit. And this is a lower motor neuron phenomenon, like we talked about those patterns of injury. And so usually the tone in the muscles is floppy and the reflexes are absent. And then even beyond the exam, you also want to know, well, what's the context? This patient sort of was sleeping over a chair, which is a pretty good story for this type of neuropathy. But if it was a prisoner who was wearing handcuffs, if it was someone who's on crutches because of a leg injury, those are all common causes of this type of neuropathy. And specifically in this patient, something we call Saturday night palsy, which just means that you go out on Saturday night, you have a good time, you kind of pass out on a chair, and you wake up the next day with this weakness or palsy, sort of a term that somebody came up with a long time ago. In opposition, you have the hand knob stroke. So again, this just shows you that those fibers of the motor pathway and the homunculus, the little man, and the hand has a large representation, because you can imagine the hands have so much fine motor control that it's sort of overrepresented in the brain because it's such a important part of our motor function. So it's a pretty big area, but it really is it's just that little area. So when you have a stroke of the hand knob or of the motor cortex, you wouldn't expect a sensory problem because that's a different part of the brain. And again, the stroke would have to be very, very specific and be sort of fortuitous enough, I guess, to spare other parts of the motor cortex, the face, the leg, for example, or even higher up in the arm. You also see upper motor neuron signs, which include weakness in a certain pattern. You can have increased tone and increased reflexes, although when it first comes on, you might be fooled and it might look more lower motor neuron. But also you want to think about, well, what are this patient's risk factors for having a stroke? If this is a young person in their 20s who went out drinking, they're at risk for having a stroke, but not compared to someone who has other problems like high blood pressure, diabetes. So knowing the patient helps you distinguish what's sort of the most likely problem. So our patient, when we saw him, or I keep going him, her, we saw her, had a very classic story for a compression of the radial nerve, given what had happened the night before, and had examination that was consistent with lower motor neuron weakness and tingling along the back of the hand, which is very specific to the radial nerve. So we were able to say, this is a radial nerve palsy. You don't need to worry about imaging the brain. And then we were able to guide treatment, and usually the treatment is physical therapy, and these type of injuries usually just get better over time. So again, this case, I think, highlights knowing the relationships of neuroanatomy, so knowing in the brain what structures are near each other, but also knowing the anatomy of peripheral nerves and what muscles specific nerves control, and knowing what type of sensory deficits you might expect. So I sort of call this know the neighborhood. So if you're dealing with a symptom and you think it's in that area, does it make sense that other symptoms aren't there almost? So why is the sensory here, or why is it out? And that can help you understand exactly which type of problem you're dealing with. So just to sort of show the opposite side of that, another case that we had was an older person who had high blood pressure and woke up with numbness over the arm, the trunk, the back, as well as the leg. So, not just the hand, but multiple parts of the body. Again, patient woke up and had these symptoms. Wasn't too troubled by them, so didn't come to the hospital right away, but they weren't getting better, so finally came in. There was no involvement of the face. There was no weakness, and the reflexes were normal. But the numbness was in a certain pattern, what I call circumferential, meaning that if you were to look at the arm, it would be the entire arm all the way around, not just the back or the front. And so when you look at the sensory pathways, which is very similar to the motor ones, again, you have a sensory cortex where nerves travel from there's a homunculus for the sensory portion as well. They travel down the brainstem into the spinal cord and then again sort of go out to their targets. The one thing to know is that the facial sensation comes in at the brainstem, whereas body sensation comes into the spinal cord. So hearing about the case, and this is another figure showing the different relationship of motor and sensory pathways within the spinal cord. And I show this just to show again, knowing your neighborhood, they're all very close together, the red and the blue, the sensory and the motor. So hearing about this case for the initially, I said, well, this patient has sensory loss over the body, the arm, and the leg, but it's not involving the face. It's on one side. I think this is a problem in the spinal cord, which is fine and dandy, but then you have to sort of think, well, why would this patient have a problem in the spinal cord? They woke up. They have no problems with neck pain. They don't have any bowel or bladder symptoms. They don't have a sensory level like we talked about over the trunk. And so you always have to go back with, well, how did this occur? And again, this was something that someone woke up and had new symptoms. And I think you always have to think about stroke in that situation. And these images don't project well at all. I apologize. It looks better on my screen. But basically, this was an MRI scan showing that there were sort of very targeted strokes within a few areas of the sensory cortex. So sort of unusual, and I have to admit it was the first time I've seen a sort of strokes like that. But it taught me that knowing the anatomy is one thing, but then you always have to go back to, well, what's the clinical context? What makes the most sense for your patients? And you should, even if it doesn't sort of make perfect sense in terms of the anatomy, you always have to go back with, when do symptoms come on and what's likely to occur in this patient? So I apologize, that just didn't project well. So lessons from this case, again, knowing neuroanatomy and the relationship between different structures within the brain, spinal cord, and nerves, knowing what's in the neighborhood of those symptoms, and then knowing what sort of what neighbors are there and what neighbors aren't there, using the examination to distinguish between different causes of a common symptom, weakness of the hand, for example, but then always going back to, when did this happen, who is this person, what's likely to have caused a problem. So that was case two, and I'll move on to the next case. So this is a case of the man who slowed down. So this was a patient that I saw in clinic, an elderly man who had multiple medical problems, including severe gastric reflux disease, to the point that he was causing injury to the esophagus because of the acidity and having a lot of nausea and vomiting. So he actually was admitted to the hospital and had surgery to repair this loose valve that was causing all the acidity to come up into his esophagus. He did well after surgery and came back for follow-up to see his surgeon, who noticed that he basically would not stop drooling in clinic and just looked very different than when she had seen him. He had been losing a lot of weight and had a lot of difficulty swallowing, and basically said, I'm not sure what's causing this, but let's have you seen by the neurologist. It seems like there's something going on that's causing these symptoms. So when he came to clinic, his partner also noticed that beyond the sort of drooling and difficulty eating, he was just walking a lot slower than usual, and eating was a chore. Every bite was, 10 to 15 bites before he would lose interest. He also had a hard time sort of getting out of a chair and even walking. And what I noticed on examination was that he had marked, the term that I use is bradykinesia. Brady meaning slow and kinesia meaning movement. So just very slow to do anything. Any sort of movement was very slow to initiate. It took a long time for him to get up out of a chair and to start walking. There was a lack of sort of facial expressions, decreased blinking, kind of a sort of stared appearance, just kind of seemed a little bit out of it. Although when you tested his cognition, it was very sharp. He had a lot of stiffness and rigidity in his arms and a little bit in his legs. His handwriting had dramatically changed, and when he walked, he was very slow with a stooped posture and took several steps just to make sort of a 360 turn. He also was very unstable and was prone to sort of falling backwards, and his partner was kind of walking alongside and just making sure that he didn't fall along with me. So clearly a problem more than just drooling and difficulty swallowing, and sort of being a neurologist, I was able to recognize this pattern of Parkinsonism, which I talked a little bit about earlier. And this is a constellation of findings, which has four main symptoms: resting tremor, which this patient really didn't have, but rigidity of the limbs, bradykinesia, and postural instability, meaning this sort of difficulty with walking and falling backward. There's a lot of other associated symptoms, a lot of which this patient had. So based on my examination, even though the symptom didn't necessarily make me think about that, I could say that this patient definitely had Parkinsonism, and that sort of put me into a very specific diagnostic category. So when you see Parkinsonism, the first thing you think about is Parkinson's disease, which is a disease of neurodegeneration that slowly progresses over many, many years. And it's thought to be related to abnormal amounts of a specific neurotransmitter called dopamine. This neurotransmitter or chemical that circulates through the brain is sort of synthesized in the brainstem and then travels up to these nuclei in the center of the brain called the basal ganglia. And abnormalities in that neurotransmitter lead to dysfunction of those nuclei, which are involved with planning of motor activity. And so when those things are affected, everything's just sort of slower to initiate. The treatment for these for Parkinson's disease is replacing the body's dopamine with medication. There are also other dementia illnesses that are associated with Parkinsonism, and I just listed a couple there that people may have heard about. And this just shows, again, a side view of the brain. Just wanted to highlight where the basal ganglia are. So remember the other picture we looked at, we saw the temporal lobe. This is actually, if you're sort of going inside of the brain, there's a set of nuclei that are listed here that interact with the brainstem, the substantia nigra, which is where that dopamine neurotransmitter is made. So aside from Parkinson's disease, which I was pretty convinced this patient didn't have since everything developed over a month and usually develops over years, is Parkinsonism or secondary Parkinsonism. So something else that's causing him to appear to have Parkinson's disease. And knowing that list of things helped me really figure out what was causing this patient's problems. So there are a class of medications that actually block dopamine activity, specifically anti-nausea medications and antipsychotic medications for patients with schizophrenia. There are also infections that can involve those structures within the brain, such as West Nile virus. There are certain toxins, including carbon monoxide poisoning, and certain recreational drugs. And then there's some more sort of metabolic or genetic disorders that involve abnormal accumulation of different minerals within the basal ganglia. So these are some sort of less common causes, but the patients can look the same, just have different etiologies or different causes of their problems. So going back to the patient, we said, like I was saying, it was sort of too fast for Parkinson's disease. But when we reviewed his medications, we found that he was taking a antiemetic or anti-nausea medication 4 to 6 times a day. And the patient had been giving a medication that was sort of, you take it as you need it when you feel nauseous, but sort of had misinterpreted that and was taking it around the clock for the whole month, even when he wasn't nauseous. And so because of that sort of, he took a lot of that medication, it led to what we call secondary Parkinsonism and his symptoms. So by stopping the medication, his symptoms were able to slowly improve over the next couple of weeks. So another case of sort of Parkinsonism was a very interesting case that we saw. This was a young man who had actually been flown by his family to San Francisco from Central America for evaluation of a more sort of chronic progressive disorder involving tremor, again, bradykinesia and difficulty walking, as well as, in opposed to the patient we just talked about, these sort of abnormal twitching movements of his entire body, which were becoming more and more frequent. The other thing that was different about this young man was that he had very prominent problems with cognitive function. He had sort of stopped talking beyond more than a few words, and this is in stark contrast to him working as a lawyer in a law firm in Central America and now being unable to work. No similar symptoms in his family. We always think about genetic causes in young people. When I examined him, he was very disoriented, could only answer to questions in 1 to 2 words. He also had Parkinsonism and the symptoms I'm sort of describing there, but also had myoclonus, which is a specific type of twitching movement or jerking movement of the arms and legs. It would happen sort of in a regular pattern every few seconds. So here we had a young patient with Parkinsonism, again, sort of very unusual to have Parkinson's disease given his age. Also, Parkinson's disease usually don't have problems with cognitive function until much later in the disease. And then he also had these unusual twitching movements. So we said, well, he's got Parkinsonism. How does that help us with the differential diagnosis? And then we started thinking about, you know, could this be some sort of toxic exposure? Does he have an infection or inflammatory condition that's causing this and involving those structures that we know can cause Parkinsonism? So that helped us sort of put him into a diagnostic box, and then we used our additional tools, MRI, lumbar puncture, and EEG, to help distinguish between these categories. His MRI was abnormal, but not very specific for any type of problem. But his lumbar puncture was also abnormal and showing, I won't go into the details of what these tests exactly mean, but basically they're markers of inflammation within the CSF, which is the fluid that surrounds the brain. So based on that, we knew that this was a inflammatory process that's involving the brain. So now we had inflammation and Parkinsonism, and that helped us narrow the differential even further. And then this was his EEG. It's actually the EEG I showed you before, and what I didn't say was that actually this EEG is very abnormal. And he was having these high amplitude discharges, hopefully you can appreciate that, every few seconds, and these corresponded with these twitching movements. And when our epileptologist looked at the EEG, he described, again, these high amplitude periodic discharges, which he said I'd never seen before, for one, but two, basically, is the only one thing I know that can cause this pattern of EEG, and that's something called subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, or in medicine we like to use acronyms, SSPE. And so basically we went from having a patient with Parkinsonism using our diagnostic tools and then being able to come up with a diagnosis within a few days. And then SSPE, which we had to sort of learn about because none of us had seen it in our training, is a rare disorder of the nervous system that's related to a latent measles infection. So it's usually a pediatric disease where a child has measles infection, and then years later there's a reactivation of the measles virus within the brain, causes sort of widespread injury and inflammation, and can cause these very severe symptoms. So knowing this information, we were able to confirm the diagnosis by sending testing for anti-measles antibodies from the fluid around the brain. And then knowing this, we went back and talked to his mom, and she said, yes, he actually did have measles at age 16. So I sort of described a little bit about what SSPE is. Without treatment, it just sort of insidiously progresses to coma and death. And the treatments we have are not great. This patient we were able to treat by basically putting a catheter into his brain and for a couple months give anti-inflammatory medications directly into his brain. So he was in the hospital for a long time. But fortunately, he improved and actually was able to return to Central America. So lessons from these two cases. One is that appreciating patterns within the neurologic examination can help guide the differential diagnosis, especially when the symptoms are not entirely clear to one place. We talked a little bit about Parkinsonism and contrast to Parkinson's disease. And then once you have a category, using your lab testing to help complement what you found to figure out what's happening. And then the term that we often use in medicine is pathognomonic, which basically just means that lab finding or that clinical finding is basically found in that disease only and nothing else. So for example, in this case, that EEG finding was pathognomonic for that diagnosis of SSP. Nothing else can cause that. So if you get one of those, you're sort of lucky, or you figured out the case. So next case is called the missing nerves. So in a teaching hospital, a lot of our teaching involved residents seeing patients in the middle of the night and then presenting to attendings or the sort of faculty in the morning about what they saw. So this was a case that I heard about from one of the residents overnight. So there's a patient who was 70 years old who came in with 1 year of weight loss, progressive difficulty with weakness and difficulty breathing, and then more recently had double vision and drooping of his eyelids that was specifically worse at night and better in the morning. He saw two objects at once, and by closing one of his eyes or the others, the two objects went away, which helps us understand that it's not a problem in the eye, but within the brain. The patient said that there was sort of marked weakness of all of the limbs, and the patient was unable to get out of bed. And also on their examination, they described multiple cranial neuropathies. So go back to the slide we had earlier in the talk where we talked about the cranial nerves. And as you'll remember, there are a set of nerves that travel out of the brainstem, which is the lower part of the brain. And they control a lot of different functions, which include vision, hearing, taste, and movement of the eye muscles, as well as swallowing. The nerves often travel, the nerves are often sort of bunched together. So a couple of the nerves sort of come out at the same place. and then they travel out of the brain through the skull, and then they go to their targets in the face or within the eye or within the tongue. So this resident who saw the patient said, you know, on my examination, the patient had a hard time moving the left side up, moving his eye on the left side. So I think there's a problem with the ocular motor nerve on that side. He also had difficulty on the right side. So I think there's a problem with one of the other nerves that controls eye movements, the abducens on the other side of the brain. He had weakness of the facial nerve or facial droop on both sides. I think both of those are affected. And then he also had difficulty with his speech and swallowing. So I think the nerves that in control that are also affected. So basically, he sort of felt like there were a bunch of nerves that had been injured by this process. So in the summary, a part of the resident's presentation, he said, this is a patient with multiple cranial neuropathies, weight loss, and generalized weakness. And so that's how it was sort of presented. And so hearing that, I said, well, when you have that type of presentation, you worry about the space where all the nerves travel. So the nerves travel as they exit the brain through a space called the subarachnoid space, which is where that CSF fluid bathes the brain. So if there's inflammation within the CSF, it can injure nerves and it can be sort of in a random pattern as they exit the brain. And so when I see that pattern where nerves on both sides of the body and different nerves are being picked off, I worry about something that's causing inflammation in that space. And in a patient of this age, we often worry about a cancerous process that's spread sort of to the brain. So I started talking about, well, let's do a lumbar puncture to sample that fluid and start looking for signs of cancer and infection. But I was sort of cut off by one of my senior colleagues who said, you know, that's all well and good, but I don't know if you noticed, but every nerve that he talked about controls motor function. He talked about function of the eye muscles and function of swallowing and function of the face movement. But why are the nerves of taste, the nerves of hearing, the nerves of sensation, why are those sort of miraculously not affected or saved? And I sort of took a step back and said, yeah, that is funny. Why would this inflammatory process sort of decide which nerves to choose? That doesn't make any sense. So what he sort of said, well, you know, if it's not the nerve, it's all the motor function, then maybe the problem is not in the nerve like you think it is, but it's actually a problem within the muscles around the eye, the muscles of speech and swallowing, the muscles that control facial movement, or the junction between the nerves and the muscles, the so-called neuromuscular junction, which makes a lot more sense. So this is something that is called framing bias, which is sort of a term in psychology where the same problem receives different responses depending on how it's described. And I think as a sort of young neurologist, I realized that we're often prone to these type of errors. We're hearing information from other doctors, from other people, including patients, presented in a certain way. And data, even though it shouldn't be biased, is always going to be biased. And so when something's presented as multiple cranial neuropathies as opposed to multiple motor nerves affected of the brain, the way you think about it is very different. And so as a sort of more senior person now, I have to take a step back or at least remind myself that you have to always interpret the data yourself. Don't let someone else do it for you and don't get caught up in this type of bias. So it's sort of a good lesson for me to think about how things are presented to you. So going back to this patient, we thought that, you know, it made a lot more sense that this was a problem of neuromuscular junction. One interesting feature of disorders of this part of the nervous system is that the symptoms can fluctuate throughout the day. And it's usually worse at night and better in the morning because it gets worse as the muscles are used more often. And the classic problem that affects the neuromuscular junction is something called myasthenia gravis. So this is a diagram of the neuromuscular junction. This is sort of the end of the nerve. This is the connection or the space between the nerve and the muscle. And basically there are these receptors on the muscle end that accept signaling molecules from the nerve that then tell the muscle to activate. And this is just a microscope. This is sort of a cartoon that's a microscope showing the same thing. But these receptors specifically take up a molecule called acetylcholine. And myasthenia gravis is a disorder where antibodies form that attack these receptors and cause injury to the receptors, so the communication between the nerve and the muscle becomes impaired. So that's sort of what I just said. for some reason, and we don't completely understand why, it seems to often involve the muscles of the eyes and the face, and then it can either stay there or can spread to the rest of the body, and nobody understands exactly why that is. It's not a static problem. Like I said, it can fluctuate during the day. And in severe cases, the muscles that control breathing can be affected, and these people need mechanical ventilation, at least in the short term. We confirmed the diagnosis by doing a nerve conduction test to study the function of the neuromuscular junction by using sort of electrical shocks and measurements of nerve activity. We also then test for the specific antibodies against that receptor. The treatment, as with other autoimmune diseases, is giving immunosuppression such as steroids. Sometimes these antibodies are associated with certain types of tumors, so knowing you have the diagnosis, you also do a search for these type of tumors that involve the thymus gland, which is a gland in the neck, and then you remove that tumor if you do find it. Another type of bias that we often deal with in medicine is the recency bias, where if I see an interesting case, it's sort of stuck in my head, and I see the next patient a couple of days later with similar symptoms, my immediate thought is, oh, this patient has the same thing I just saw. How interesting is that? But that's a fallacy. So I saw a patient a week later after that patient who had double vision right after waking up from surgery, a heart transplant surgery. She had never had double vision in her life. It was a brand new symptom for her. And so initially I thought, oh, this could be myasthenia gravis. Maybe it was sort of brought out by the surgery. But you always have to go back to the context. And thinking about it further, I said, well, she also just had major cardiac surgery where they put her on a bypass machine. And so more likely that she had a small stroke involving the same type of nuclei that control muscles. And indeed, she ended up having a stroke. So you can't get caught up in what you saw last week. You have to think about each patient differently. So it's another bias that I sort of learned from. So these cases, again, sort of I hopefully taught me, and hopefully you guys also understand a little bit about the biases and errors that that can occur when you're hearing about cases, but being mindful of them, you can sort of overcome them. A phrase that one of our old chairmen always used to say is that the last neurologist is always the smartest. So, you know, that's something else to always keep in mind. Keeps you humble as well. We have a couple more cases. This is a case called The Picture Worth a Thousand Diagnoses. So this was a 35-year-old man with HIV disease and immunodeficiency who came in with several months of a variety of symptoms, including weakness of his hand, difficulty finding the right words and talking to his family, difficulty controlling his hand with frequent twitching of his left hand. He also had difficulty twitching of his left hand. On examination, he had upper motor neuron signs of weakness. He had difficulty with language and aphasia, and he had continual shaking of his hand that we were concerned could be a seizure. So he, in terms of his anatomy, had sort of clearly the brain was involved, not the spinal cord or the nerves, but it was sort of involving different parts of the brain, not all of it once, but kind of patchy in different parts. So motor cortex, language function, visual problems with the occipital lobe. And in thinking about HIV or immunocompromised patients in particular, you sort of have to think broadly because they're at risk for a lot of different things, including infections that other people are just not at risk for. So you have an examination that suggests multifocal problem. You have a patient that could have a variety of things. So you really need to use your diagnostic testing. In this case, the cerebral spinal fluid analysis wasn't particularly helpful. The EEG just confirmed that he was having seizures but didn't tell us why he was having seizures. And so the thing that was most helpful was the MRI scan. So again, to orient everybody, these are axial slices where these are the eyes. And hopefully you remember the MRI scan that I showed earlier in the presentation that was normal, and you can appreciate there's this gross abnormality here with this sort of high signal within the white matter of the brain. And this is just two different slices showing sort of how diffuse it is. So this was described as multifocal plaque-like abnormalities limited to the white matter and sparing the gray. It involved both hemispheres, which made sense given our exam and the patient's symptoms. And also, the areas didn't enhance. And by that, I mean it's a specific sort of parameter of imaging where we give someone contrast to see if contrast goes into that area of injury. And in this patient, it didn't. And that helps us understand what type of injury it is. There also wasn't any swelling associated with that injury, which is another helpful sign when you see it on imaging. So we basically went from a patient with a lot of different symptoms who's at risk for a lot of things, and with our diagnostic testing, we're able to narrow the differential quite a bit based on where, what type of injury it was. It was involving just the white matter, and then whether there were things like mass effect or enhancement. And in this case, we sort of fall down in this category, and basically there's two possibilities. One is a viral encephalitis, which just means inflammation of the brain related to the HIV itself, or an encephalitis related to another type of virus called the JC virus that causes a syndrome called progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy. Mass effect just means swelling or edema around that lesion. So this patient ended up having this diagnosis based on some additional testing, and this is basically a demyelinating, meaning injury of the white matter, disease of the brain associated with the specific virus, the JC virus, which is just named after the first patient. And it's only seen in patients who are immunocompromised. It causes progressive neurologic syndromes as the white matter sort of expands within the brain, and you make the diagnosis by sort of finding or proving that the patient has the virus in their CSF fluid. There's no specific treatment for this infection. It's really just getting their immune system boosted up to try to fight the infection. So I think lessons from this case, localization of the examination may not lead you to one specific part of the brain, but at least it can help you distinguish between brain and spinal cord. And then at that point, you really have to use your tools to help narrow the differential. And again, this patient is at risk for a lot of different infections, which I didn't get into, but with the imaging, we were really able to narrow it down to one or two possibilities, and that guides our specific test to confirm the diagnosis. So this is our last case, the teenager who began hitting her brother for no reason. So this was an 18-year-old woman who came to the emergency room after witness seizure activity that was sort of continuous after having no history of seizures prior to that. In talking to her parents, they said that about a month ago, her personality seemed to change. She suddenly became very prone to irritability, very angry, was literally getting into physical fights with her younger brother over very minor things, stopped sort of paying attention in school, stopped caring about her grades, and before had been a very studious student. Over the last week, they thought that she just seemed very distant, was kind of staring off into space, had sort of stopped talking, and they also thought that she was sort of having hallucinations and interacting with things that weren't around in the actual room. She had had, and after all this, she had her seizure at home, and that's when they sort of panicked appropriately and brought her to the emergency room, where she continued to have more seizures. So our first step was giving her anti-seizure medications and getting these under control. Ultimately had to put her into a medication-induced coma to control the seizures. So at that point, we didn't really have a great examination because we're sort of putting her into a coma to control the seizures. And so we rely again on our testing. And in this case, the imaging wasn't particularly helpful, but her CSF, the lumbar puncture analysis, was very abnormal with, again, evidence of inflammation. So this patient, just like one of the other ones I described, was actually seen by the on-call sort of resident who's training in neurology, who went through the case in the morning and said, you know, I was very impressed by this very dramatic prodrome of symptoms over the last month that culminated with seizures. The CSF is inflammatory, and based on that, I'm pretty confident that this patient has either herpes encephalitis, which is sort of the most common cause of infectious encephalitis involving the brain, or an autoimmune disorder called NMDA receptor encephalitis. So what is NMDA encephalitis? Well, it's a disorder that tends to affect young women much more than men. It has a prodrome very similar to our patient with a dramatic personality change and mood changes, hallucinations, and paranoia. Then it progresses to involve loss of cognitive function and loss of language. And it culminates with patients basically becoming comatose, having frequent seizures, bedbound, and having a lot of difficulty with heart rate being very fast, high blood pressure, and high fevers. It's an autoimmune disorder in which antibodies are formed against the specific receptor, the NMDA receptor, which is a receptor between synapses within the brain. And 50% of cases are associated with a specific type of benign tumor involving the ovaries, something called a teratoma. And what a teratoma is an abnormal growth that actually involves tissue from all different parts of the body, even though it's localized within the ovary. So when they look under these, under the slide, they actually see tissue from the brain, tissue from the gut, tissue from teeth cells that's sort of abnormally growing in some in ovaries, but also can grow in men as well. And so the idea is that these antibodies are formed because the body's trying to sort of control this tumor. It forms against the neural tissue, and then it gets confused and starts attacking the patient's own brain, which leads to this very dramatic encephalitis. So this is a pathology slide, and the only reason I put this up there is just to hopefully you can appreciate that looking at this under the microscope, there's parts of this slide that are just dramatically different than other parts. And this just highlights that teratomas have different tissues from different parts of the body, including brain tissue. So in our patient, we were worried about herpes encephalitis. When that testing came back negative, our suspicion for NMDA encephalitis went up much higher. Unfortunately, it's such a rare disease that the testing takes several weeks to sort of come back and be confirmed. But we went ahead and said, well, let's look for an ovarian tumor, knowing that 50% of the cases have it. And indeed, this patient had an ultrasound that showed an ovarian mass. After the NMDA came back positive, we went ahead with the family's consent to take out the ovary, and she indeed had a teratoma. And with removal of the tumor and, again, medications to suppress her immune system, she slowly improved over the next couple weeks. So the reason I bring up this case, one that is sort of very dramatic, but I think it's an interesting thing about medicine, was that this case was actually, this sort of whole entity wasn't fully described until very recently in 2007. So that's sort of when the first paper came out saying this is the syndrome, this is the antibody that causes it, and in 50% of the cases it's associated with this tumor. Really before then, nobody knew what this was or had any concept of what this type of encephalitis is. But now, you know, less than 10 years later, it's so well known and so well described, probably because it's so fascinating, that a neurology resident in their beginning of training can make the diagnosis, you know, after seeing the patient once in the emergency room. And that's in contrast to 15 years ago when the diagnosis, while the patients existed, the diagnosis didn't. So this sort of brings me to my last point, that we have the great benefit of the expertise of people around the world and using the internet to search for answers. So this helps us with diagnosis of rare diseases that have very specific features, that there might only be a few cases around the world. It helps us with decisions about treatment. We made the diagnosis, but none of us has ever treated it. How do we treat it? Reading how other people have done it. And basically, it helps you sort of guide your differential diagnosis when you're sort of hitting an endpoint. But you have to get there by using the tools we had. So knowing that the CSF was inflammatory, knowing the history of this prolonged syndrome helped us understand what type of syndrome this patient might have. Another example of this, even more sort of extreme, one of my colleagues saw a patient in her 20s who had developed deafness as a teenager and now had progressive weakness and difficulty eating. And on examination, my colleague found that she had symptoms concerning for motor neuron disease involving the facial muscles. And motor neuron disease, I talked briefly about, is sort of the pattern of disease we see with Lou Gehrig's or ALS. But given her young age, she would be the wrong sort of demographic for Lou Gehrig's, and he was concerned about a genetic syndrome. So he went to Google Scholar and just typed in a bunch of buzz terms and said, I think this is genetic, the patient has deaf, bulbar just refers to mouth or oral area, and then motor neuron disease. Hit search, and a bunch of articles came up, but one of them down here is a syndrome with, you know, named after probably four or five famous neurologists around the world that he or nobody else had ever heard of, but had a bulbar palsy with deafness and caused by a civic mutation. Able to click on that article, read about it, learn about it, and then say, you know what, I think this patient actually fits this, and then able to send off genetic testing and also communicate with the doctors who are sort of the experts. And I think there's something like 50 or 60 cases that have been described around the world. So you don't always have to know every single disease that exists, especially genetic ones, but if you can use the internet and the tools and your examination to narrow it down, you can come upon the answer. So again, I think these cases really highlight the sort of power of increased medical knowledge that's available to us over the internet. But also the reality is that there's also a lot more information available to patients. And I think one of our jobs as doctors is to always guide our patients to good information. And I often tell them about handouts or good websites that I think are accurate and have good information about their diagnosis. So to summarize, we talked a little bit about the tools that are available to neurology detectives. We talked about the importance of history, the neurologic examination, as well as diagnostic testing, and then having the sort of the internet and being able to get information from our peers around the world. We learned about how different diseases require a different balance of these different tools, and some of the tools are more important than others depending on what you're dealing with. And then we also talked about some of the errors that we can make as diagnosticians and how to be aware of those and then sort of work around them when you're presented with clinical data. So I wanted to thank Dr. Singh and Dr. Tabas for inviting me and for all of you for listening to the Mini Medical School. I wanted to also thank all of my mentors and teachers and as well as my residents and students and, of course, all my patients and their families over the years. So I thought I'd stop there, but if anybody has questions, I'm happy to take them. Yes?
Besides all the imaging and things that you go to after you've done your initial workup of the patient, what sort of tools do you have in your office when a patient comes in that you can do right there, and then beside the hammer?
Yeah.
What sort of tools do you have in your bag?
So neurologists have a lot of tools. I sort of glossed over a lot of the things, but you can actually spend hours just testing someone's sensation if you really wanted to. And the way we do this, we have different tools, tuning forks that produce a certain type of vibration sensation. We have very sort of precise filaments of different sort of gradation to test how accurately they can test different parts of sensation. We have things of different temperature that we use to test temperature sensation. We often will have like salt and sugar to test taste if that's the type of symptom people are dealing with. And we also use things like a safety pin to test pain sensation. And then there's also a lot of different tools that we use for testing, for example, eye function. So we often use an ophthalmoscope. We often, you know, it's very important to look in the back of the eye to test the response of reflexes to light. Look in the ear. Sometimes that can be helpful for us as neurologists. And then even within the visual system, there's a lot of other tools that we use. We have things of different colors. If people are saying, I have difficulty appreciating different colors, we have sort of standardized colors, things that we use to test that. So a lot of it sort of depends on your specific specialty. And I don't use every tool for every patient. It's sort of guided by what type of symptoms they have.
Yeah, is there any difference the way a hemorrhagic stroke presents as opposed to a blood clot thrombotic stroke? And is there anything you can do clinically for the hemorrhagic stroke? Is there surgery or something?
Yeah, that's a great question. So so I can go back a little bit. But when we talked a little bit about stroke at the very beginning, I sort of didn't talk much about hemorrhagic stroke, but there's two types of strokes. In the United States, about 80% of strokes are ischemic, where there's a blockage of the artery, and 20% are hemorrhagic, where there's kind of, you can imagine sort of a leak in the vessel and blood leaks out into the brain area. Clinically, when someone comes to the emergency room, they can look very similar. The couple of things that can be helpful is that usually when there's bleeding or hemorrhagic stroke, it's associated with very high blood pressure. So seeing someone's blood pressure when they come in can be a clue. In addition, people with hemorrhagic stroke, if the bleeding is expanding over time, will often get worse as you're evaluating them in the emergency room. So they might come in sort of having some weakness, and then you come back in the room 10 minutes later, and now they're not talking, and then it sort of progresses like that. That can be a sign to me that this is probably a bleed rather than a blood clot. But really the best way to prove that is with the CT scan. And blood appears bright white, so it's not hard to miss. And it's very important to make that distinction because you wouldn't give a patient with a bleed the blood thinning medication. That'll make it worse. So in terms of treatments that we have, it really depends on where the bleeding is. If the bleeding is so extreme and increasing, it starts creating increased pressure in the brain. And one of the benefits of the way we were created is that we have a very hard skull that protects us from flying objects. But when there's swelling within the brain, the skull becomes a detriment because there's no room for the brain to swell, and that causes more injury. So really the treatment, depending on the amount of swelling, is actually relieving the swelling, sometimes with surgery to take off part of the skull and decompress, or giving medications to lower pressure. There's a variety of medications we can give to lower pressure. The other thing we want to do is lower blood pressure as quickly as possible to prevent more bleeding. Sometimes bleeding is associated with medications like blood thinners or clotting disorders or bleeding disorders. So we also give medications to reverse the effects of medications. So the treatment's very different.
So in the ischemic stroke example you used,
yeah,
the man fell down, you were lucky. You were,
yes,
able to find a good witness. What if it hadn't been and you couldn't narrow that time window down? Maybe it was 3 hours, maybe it was 8 hours.
Yeah.
What would you have done?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think the way the medical practice works now, if you were not able to know for sure, and the information we had was the last person that saw him normal was his wife at 5 a.m., then I think most doctors, including me, probably would not give that medication.
The risk of the medication is
crucial. Right. Exactly. I think everybody will be different. Some people might say, well, if I go and talk to the wife and say, here's a situation, I can give this medication, which has a chance to work, but there's also a chance of a bad side effect. And these are the side effects or the complications. Because the concern is that if you give the clot busting medication too late, it can cause bleeding within the brain and cause more injury. So you have to give it within a certain time before the brain tissue has infarcted or died away completely. And so some people might say, well, if the family member sort of says, I understand the risk and I want to proceed, then they would be okay with that. And I think everybody has a little bit different threshold. One thing that we're working on is, can our imaging tools actually help us age how old the blood clot is? And so that's sort of the new stuff that's coming out, because another common situation is a patient wakes up, like one of the patients I described with symptoms. The patient I described had some numbness over their body and actually wasn't even concerned enough to come to the hospital. But you can imagine if our gentleman who woke up in the morning, his wife turned over and he wasn't talking, wasn't moving the side of the leg, he would come to the emergency room right away. But you'd be stuck with a situation where, well, you know, he was normal when he went to bed at 10 o'clock last night, but when I woke up at 6 a.m., he wasn't. And so how do you know when that stroke happened? There's no way you would know. So we're hoping that with imaging tools we can understand that better. But I think the reality is that most people would not give that clot-busting medication because it does have a high potential for side effects. There are other things, like this gentleman, we were able to go in and pull the clot out with the mechanical device. And some people would say, well, if we can't do that, let's try to do that. But it is a tough situation, unfortunately. I think the other reason that I always want to talk about stroke is when people are having stroke, the mind plays a trick somehow, and you sort of somehow tell yourself, this is not a big deal. This is fine. I'm not actually having a stroke. I'm totally fine. They don't even recognize they're having symptoms. So a lot of people who are having a stroke by themselves won't get help because they don't even realize it's happening. It's really the spouse or the son or the daughter, or in this case, sort of a bystander who recognizes there's something really wrong. This patient needs to get to the hospital, because people rarely have strokes and know that they're having one and bring themselves in. Yeah.
If you were to give the TPA, how detectable are the bad effects you don't want, and how reversible is that situation?
So the risk goes up the longer you wait after the stroke, if you don't know when the stroke happened. And what happens, even in the patients who get the medication on time, about 5% of them will have what we call symptomatic hemorrhage within the brain, meaning the blood clot medication goes through the system, but it causes bleeding that worsens the symptoms they came in with in 5% of the cases. And that number goes up the longer you wait after the stroke came on. In terms of reversing it, you're basically now dealing from an ischemic stroke to a hemorrhagic stroke, like the other gentleman talked about. And so the reversing it involves doing things to reduce pressure in the brain, lowering the blood pressure. But you can't get rid of the blood. You can't just get it sort of sucked up, unfortunately. So it is a big problem to deal with. Yeah. Yeah.
Just wanted to know, is there early changes in a lot of the autoimmune, like children? has that's more like
touch temperature?
Do you find that
very things like, so we see a lot of patients with autoimmune disorders beyond the ones I talked about, which sort of specifically target the brain or the nervous system. But there are sort of more systemic autoimmune disorders like lupus or Sjogren's that involve a lot of different organs, one of which is the brain. And lupus in particular is particularly challenging because it can actually involve not only the brain, it can involve the spinal cord, it can involve the muscles, it can involve the nerves. So patients with lupus can have a variety of symptoms. So you mentioned tingling in the fingers. That's usually due to a problem in the peripheral nerves as they travel into the fingers. And that's something we sometimes see with lupus. But they can also come in with problems affecting the brain and spinal cord. So when we see that, we have to sort of, again, use our examination to understand where the numbness is coming from. And that helps us make a possible diagnosis. The other thing that's challenging about things like lupus and Sjogren's is sometimes the medications we use to treat those have neurologic side effects. So you always have to distinguish between, is it the lupus or Sjogren's or the autoimmune disease, or is it the medications that they're on for that problem? So it is something we see very commonly, but it can be a lot of different symptoms, including tingling and numbness.
So once you get that, does it go away? Potentially,
if you sort of are, if we're convinced that it's because of the autoimmune disease, then further suppressing the immune system can reverse some of those symptoms. Sometimes with neuropathy, that's not always the case. And so people might get a little bit better, but not 100%, depending on what type of injury they had to the nerves. Okay.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.